Well, hi, I'm Matt, one of the leaders at Maybridge. Hope you had a really good Easter. We're returning for the next few Sundays to our series looking at Matthew's Gospel, and we're taking our time over it, doing a bit each week, and that's because it's really, really rich. It's like caramel cheesecake covered in chocolate and syrup. It's the ancient text equivalent of that. So why it's worth our time. And it's also very much about what it is to follow Jesus in any season, pandemic or not. It's always, always, always relevant. But you know, while I believe that, sometimes you come across a passage in this book and you think, okay, that is a very strange story. And what on earth does it have to do with my life? And we've reached one of those stories today. So let me begin by telling you the whole story. And then the challenge is to answer that very reasonable question. What does this have to do with anybody in Worthing in 2021? And here it is. This is Matthew 8, verses 28 to 34. And it says, when he, that's Jesus, when he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. What do you want with us, Son of God? They shouted. Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time? Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, if you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs. He said to them, go. So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region. Do you see what I mean? Interesting story, but unless you're a concerned member of the Gadarene Bacon Preservation Society, the relevance might not be immediately obvious. Let's walk through a little more slowly. When it begins, it says, when he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. Now, some context. This is immediately after a story where Jesus and his disciples were on a boat on the Sea of Galilee. There was a massive storm. Everyone was terrified and Jesus stopped the storm dead. An incredible, epic story that made experienced professional fishermen step back in amazement. Everyone is presumably still thinking about this when they reach the other side. And this whole section of Matthew, on one level, is meant to blow you away with how powerful Jesus is and yet how he's deeply compassionate at the same time. Now, Jesus and his group of followers arrive in the region of the Gadarenes. This is just a normal group of people. They live to the east of the sea. They're Gentiles. They're not Jewish like Jesus and his followers. And that matters because one of the underlying things that Matthew, the author, is always trying to show us is that while Jesus is very Jewish and he's for Jewish people, he's also very much for people who are not Jewish too. And that covers everybody. Everybody's either Jewish or not Jewish. And straight away, it seems just as everyone's got off this boat, these two demon-possessed men approach. Now, we've touched on this previously, but it's worth saying again. The Bible assumes that demonic powers exist. Our culture is very generally sceptical about anything demonic, often with very good reason. If these men were around today, we would probably be quick to say, well, they've just got severe mental health issues. But the way the Bible understands reality accounts for both. There are mental health problems and there are demonic powers, influences that are not of God. And I suspect that sometimes we get them confused. Some people are quick to call everything a mental health problem. Others are quick to call everything some sort of spiritual or demonic attack. And it takes a lot of discernment to know what's what. But if we're to take Jesus at face value and believe him to be who he says he is, we have to face the fact that Jesus certainly believes in the existence of demonic powers and opposes them. And plenty of people watching him thought that's exactly what he was doing on a number of occasions. The two men in this story were so affected by the demons, they weren't themselves. They were consistently, uncontrollably violent. They seemed to be living in some tombs, which would have been well outside the nearest town. So this is quite an extreme situation. And the fact that nobody could pass this way makes it sound like, it was sadly a long-term thing too. And these men were known, probably even had family in the nearest town, but they were so far gone, nobody could do anything. On top of that, being demon-possessed and living among the tombs, home of the dead, made them unclean. Maybe they found their own way there. Maybe they've been brought there by people who are desperate, don't know what to do. Who knows? But they're completely now without hope. In the eyes of the world, they're unclean. They're not to be touched, not to be interacted with, not to go near. And that's when Jesus comes along. But the demons that control the men speak first, before Jesus says anything. "What do you want with us, Son of God?" they shouted. "Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?" This is really fascinating. The demons that control these men begin a conversation with Jesus, but notice this. They know who he is. This is actually very unsettling. Throughout the Gospels, people who don't know who Jesus is, even when they spend time with him, are just, there's loads of them. It's a repeated theme. And throughout history, people don't know who Jesus is. They say he's a myth, or he's a good teacher, or a great spiritual thinker, or whatever. But the demons know right away. They know. He's the Son of God. Without anything else going on, Jesus just shows up and they know it's him. And this is very unsettling because these demons know the right answer. They have the right theology. But they're demons. They're on the wrong team. They're baddies. But look at what else they say. "Have you come to torture us?" They know who Jesus is in one sense, but in another, they don't have a clue. Jesus did not come to earth just to torture demons. Jesus came to earth to set people free, to heal, to teach what God is like, and to die and rise again for his people. Now, it does say elsewhere in the Bible that when the world ends and God administers judgment, the demonic will be done with forever. It'll be gone. But that's not why Jesus is here at this point. So they recognise who he is, but they don't know what he's doing. They don't know what he's about. Jesus didn't come to torture demons. He came to rescue people. But this tiny bit of insight into the thinking of the demons reminds us it's not enough to know Jesus' title and his position. Many people can just say those words. It's that you know what he's like that really matters as well. Look at how the rest of the conversation goes. Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs." He said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. So there's a load of pigs in the distance. You may well know that Jews don't like pigs. Pigs are dirty and unclean. Jewish people don't keep herds of them. But at this moment, remember, Jesus is in Gentile territory, so some people own pigs. That's why they're around. The demons know Jesus is not going to let them controlling the two men. That regime is over the moment he shows up. They are well aware. So they beg to be sent into the pigs. And you wonder what's all this about, because they just run into the lake and die. But it could be that the demons would rather die than be tortured by Jesus, even though it seems unlikely he was going to torture them anyway. Or it could be that the demons didn't realise that the pigs would react the way they did, and the presence of these demons sent them wild and they just didn't know what they were doing. Why does Jesus let them go? It doesn't say, but it could be that because for one it wasn't yet the end of time, but I think it's also because he wants to show everyone the intention of the demons. Left alone, they would eventually destroy the men, just as they did the pigs. Demons bring nothing good, and people need to see that. But in this whole story, Jesus only says one word. One word. He says, "Go." But that word is loaded with intention. Go out of these men I'm concerned for. Go into this big herd of pigs that are less valuable to me than two human lives. Go away from me and from the people I'm here to serve. Go. Some people think that when you engage with demons and get involved with demonic powers, it's all about weird incantations and saying special formulated things, all very strange. Jesus doesn't need to do any of that. His authority is so great that in the face of powers that have the potential to utterly control a normal human being, he just says, "Go." Go. What happens after this incredible display of power and authority? Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region. Now, if you'd seen someone interact with demons and then send a load of pigs into the sea, you'd probably tell people about it too. That's an unusual afternoon. And that's exactly what the pig tenders do. They go and tell everyone at home, including what happened to the two men. This is a good news story. The two men are healed, which is great for them. It's great for their families, presumably, and great for anyone who wants to pass by these tombs without getting any hassle. What happens next, and it's how the passage ends, I think is the most surprising and most sad part of the whole story. The whole town come out to meet Jesus. This is not a welcome committee. It's not an investigation group. It's more of a mob. And they have a clear message for Jesus. "We don't want you." They pleaded with him to leave. Now think about what's happened from their point of view. They've had these two demon-possessed men causing problems for who knows how long. People can't even walk past. It's an issue. Then Jesus comes along, and in a moment, he restores the men to normality, to humanity. That's a good thing. Jesus did something good. Undeniably, unless you own the pigs and you wanted gammon for dinner. And yet they pleaded with him to leave. Why? Why would you want Jesus to leave? Because they're terrified. They don't deny that Jesus is powerful. Far from it. They're terrified of what he might do with that power. He's fixed these two men who've been a problem for the town, maybe for years. You know, we have no idea. He's fixed it in the space of 2 minutes by speaking one word. If Jesus can do that, what else can he do? What might he do in their lives if he's around? They can't control the demons. They have no chance of controlling Jesus. Notice the similarity between the demons and the people. The demons seem to know more about Jesus. The townspeople have benefited from what he does. But the demons and the townspeople are united in that they're scared of Jesus and they don't want him around. They don't want him. So what's the point of this story for us? To show yet again, yep, Jesus is amazingly powerful. Well, that's part of it. But the bigger thing, I think, is to push us, to push you and I, and actually anyone who's read this through history, to think about what we do with Jesus and whether we're too scared to be around him. People have reacted to Jesus like this ever since this happened. People are scared of the implications of having him around, of having him interfere with how they want to go about life. Now, you might think, well, hold on, I'm not too scared to be close to Jesus. I'm a follower of Jesus. I've been for ages. I love Jesus. But here's the thing. Even for the most committed follower, the most committed Christian on earth, there are parts of our lives that we don't want Jesus to touch. There are parts of our inner selves that we don't want anyone to mess with, probably even to know about. There are parts of each of us that, in a sense, plead for Jesus to leave. There's a million and one examples. It could be that you know you need to forgive someone, but you really don't want to. So internally, you might not use the words, but basically you say, Jesus, stay out of that, please. It could be that you hold on to all your money and you find security in it, even though you know you could and should be more generous. So you say, Jesus, stay out of that, please. It could be that you just habitually moan about stuff, and you know you're doing it, but it's become such a part of how you live that you say, Jesus, stay out of that, please. It could be that you're prone to overworking and being overly busy so that you don't have to deal with other things in your life. And you know you shouldn't do it, but you say, Jesus, stay out of that, please. I could go on and on, but I'm sure you know what I mean. And even if you're not a Christian yourself, you might just call this your conscience. You know you shouldn't have a certain attitude or a certain way about you, but you don't want anyone to ask questions. You want it to be nicely partitioned off and left alone. A good way to know if you're doing this is to see how you react when someone else raises something that you just want left alone. And it comes up and you go into defensiveness, you change the subject, or you get a bit aggressive, a bit touchy. I know for myself, I have some weaknesses that I'm fine to open up to, no problem to own up to, but there are other things I don't want to face, things that if I'm really honest, I don't want Jesus to interfere with. The church staff team will tell me I'm not great at communicating expectations. Fine, that's true. I'll own that. That could do with changing. Happy to own that weakness. But you know what? I can be really irritable with my family. I have been a bit more so this last year, especially with our kids. I know it. I don't want to be told about it. On some level, I want to change. But on another, I don't want to face the reality of my own impatience. And so if someone raises it, usually my wife, I immediately want to leap into denial. I am more likely to protest, to make excuses, explain the circumstances. I don't want it to be my fault. Jesus, stay out of that, please. You may have had the same experience. Even though it bugs you, or maybe even it really bothers you, you'd rather be left to deal with it than let Jesus deal with it. Why? Why do we do this? Because we're afraid. We're afraid of what will happen if we let the defences down, of what life will look like. Jesus is immensely powerful. Anyone who got close to him could see that, and it made demons and ordinary townspeople run a mile. Why would you let someone like that interfere with your life? Why would you let them have free rein to change things in your inner self? Well, the less you know about Jesus, the more likely you are to fear him. I don't mean know in the sense of reading the Bible and everything. That's very, very helpful. But I mean personally know. Know what he's like in a personal way. If you know what he's really like, you know you've got the safest pair of hands imaginable. Jesus is more trustworthy to handle your inner life than you are. You know you pretty well, and you love you quite a lot. You'll do anything for you. Well, he knows you better, and he loves you more. And the reason you can know his hands are the safest imaginable is they have deep marks on them for where he allowed himself to be crucified for you. That's how you know. And probably a lot of us know this in theory. We know the theology. Jesus died for my sins. Very good. But how personal do you allow that to get? The easy way is to sort of allow Jesus to die for your external sins and mistakes. You know, you say a nasty word, you tell a white lie, you take the last chocolate without asking, and you're sorry, and you know you're forgiven. That keeps it nice and comfortable and on the surface. We know it was a bad thing to do. We know we're forgiven, we forget and move on. But will you allow Jesus to get to work on your inner self? Will you spend the time with him? Will you be ruthlessly honest about your motivations? Will you be open to change when you really don't fancy it? Are you secure enough in who Jesus is that you will face your own brokenness and selfishness with him? Properly face it. He isn't forcing you. He could, but he doesn't. That's another way to know he's trustworthy. When the townspeople asked Jesus to leave, what did he do? Did he argue with them? No, actually, he left. You can see that in the first verse of chapter 9. They didn't want him, and so he left. And we're often the same. And yet Jesus is so good, he will not cease to love and save people whose faith in him and trust of him is only surface deep. It's incredible. Look at what Jesus is like in just this story. He only says one word, but look at him. He heals the demon-possessed men. He's God of the universe, but he doesn't say, well, this is below me, I'll get an assistant to fix it. No, he cares enough to be involved personally. He shows mercy even to the demons, even though they never show mercy to anybody. He leaves the region without fuss or complaint when he isn't wanted. And more widely, at any point when you look at Jesus, he's full of compassion. He tells the truth in love. He extends dignity to people. He avoids superficial answers. And he is unendingly ready to grant forgiveness. He knows exactly what people are like, exactly. And he loves them anyway. So the question is, isn't this somebody you can trust? I suspect for a number of us, it's about time we moved on in our walk with Jesus. We know all the right Sunday school answers. We know what we're supposed to be doing in life. We're outwardly involved in some great things. We're nice people, nice Christians. Nobody has a problem with us. But how far does your trust of Jesus to deal with who you are actually go? It's more than having good theology, and I love theology. The demons recognise who Jesus is, but they hate him. The townspeople recognise what Jesus does, but they reject him. The story is supposed to take us beyond just having the right answers. Jesus' greatness is well established by this point in the narrative that we're journeying through as a church. And of course, we just had the reminder of everything that happened at Easter. The question is, regardless of how much you know about Jesus, how far do you want him in the uncomfortable realities of life and of who you are? Are you willing to face the stuff you don't want to face about yourself with the one person who knows it already and loves you regardless? I can't answer that for you today, but I can pray. Father, thank you for everything that we see in Jesus in this passage, even through that just one word, that he is always ready, open-handed, to be with us, to interfere with the parts of our lives that we're very sensitive to having interfered with and being touched. Father, I pray that you would give us as a church a new openness to letting Jesus change us. We don't want it to be just surface deep. We want it to be really deep, the innermost part of who we are. Lord, we invite you today, through your Holy Spirit, to change us again. Lord, help us to be honest with ourselves and one another with what's really going on, with who we really are. And let us be willing to face our brokenness, our darkness, our evil for what it really is, but knowing that you unconditionally love us anyway, and you're the one that can fix us and change us. Let us not be a people that pleads with you to leave, but that begs you to come in.